hold-ups we were experiencing and the very valid reasons why. But thank you so much for being back here in time. And thank you, Mr. Holmes, alongside me. So we're now going to go straight into the presentation by National Treasury by Ms. Gibson and her colleague with her. Oh, it's not here now, but Mulala. Mulala, yeah. Right. So do go ahead. We're in your hands. And just remind us again, Ms. Gibson, the unit you're from again?
Financial sector policy, and specifically market conduct and inclusion.
Everyone will be pleased to hear that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Chair, and also to indicate that I've got Sipati here as well with me from National Treasury. More. Is that better? So I think just before we get started, two points, which is that I think it's what's emerged out of particularly the hearings, but based on the submissions and the discussions in general, has been the absolute need for us to be delving into these issues with the level of detail that we have been and really getting into the nitty-gritty, because often we have, or over the past couple of years, we get a tendency to hear very broad brush statements about what's working and what's not working and what we can be doing in response. And it's only really when we go into a process like this and we really apply a critical lens that we can really get to the heart of the matter of what exactly is working and what's not working and what we can, and forcing us and compelling us to explore options of how to remedy. This presentation that we've got here today does two things. Firstly, it highlights issues from our submission, which directly relates to the draft bill as it's been published. The draft bill as it's been published. But listening to the submissions that have been made over the course of the week, I think sometimes we, and by we, I mean us, me, sometimes we get overly locked in technical detail and we don't necessarily always take the step back that's needed to remind ourselves what are we trying to do in the first place, and are we really on the right track to do that. So this presentation then does two things. Firstly, it's a summary of our submission, but in addition to which, building on some of the submissions that have been made this week, we also take a step back and think about, well, what does this mean for where the bill is currently sitting, and how can we be making, how can we be thinking about the bill in its current form? And I think thinking about how to take it forward in a sustainable, in a way that's sustainable for the credit market, but also borrowers and credit providers in general. So I think it's what we've been clear about from the beginning is that we very much support this process and we completely acknowledge that relief is needed for poor and indigent South Africans. We've had recurring stories of spiraling debt, people getting themselves into a debt trap, the knock-on effect this has for their quality of life in terms of not being able to, in terms of funding for schooling, education, even food. And there has been, I think, much effort taken in order to address what had been observed as everything from chronic abuses to vulnerabilities and weaknesses in the credit market. And so we must always be, I think, mindful of the extensive regulatory reform program, which is already underway and which is being implemented and to a large extent has been implemented, and what we expect the results to be, the positive results to be yielding out of that. it's important for us to be thinking around, against this backdrop of the broad regulatory framework and then the current problem of just chronically over-indebted consumers who are trapped. And between that, I think we need to be thinking about, and this is a question which we need to continually be posing ourselves, is what do we want the credit market to actually look like? And how are we going to get ourselves there? So thank you very much for this opportunity to speak or present and continue the engagement. So I think the vision that we have presented, and just to highlight again, is firstly what we are looking for at the very least is to be giving South Africans that who are chronically over-indebted, and I think it's an important point, that they're chronically over-indebted today and in future. So I think it's not just, there's a point in time, which is now, and then there's a going forward, who have no chance or way to escape that debt, the opportunity of a fresh start. But we want to do this in a way that addresses moral hazard issues, both from the lender's side and the borrower's side. We don't want borrowers to take on debt thinking that their debt is going to be necessarily extinguished and therefore they can take on additional debt and be irresponsible. On the other hand, we don't want lenders who are, and we see differences between first lenders and last lenders, and we need to think about whether it's fair that the last lenders who actually are maybe be over the tipping point, they're actually treated the same as the first lenders who maybe hadn't caused the issues in the first place, but I know there's some controversy around that. We're looking for, and I know these are elements which get picked up in the...
Just one moment, Ms. Gibson. If you could just explain that again for some of us who, you know, been here for all the hearings and that, we clearly understand what you're getting at. And I know this was raised within the committee, the issue of the last one in.
So I think this is not just for this scenario of the extinguishing of debt. I think there's a general principle issue here in terms of how how lenders are treated when they go into, for example, whether it's a debt review process or something else, debt extinguishing. And there's a question around, particularly related to reckless lending, when does a loan, if there are multiple loans that are issued, which is the loan, multiple loans issued successively, at which point does the loan become reckless? And so there is a question around if the initial loans were not reckless, but there are reckless lenders, and then the borrower gets into trouble, is it fair that all of those lenders are treated the same, given that what incentive that creates is that for the lender who's lent last, they know they're going to share the cost with actually the lenders who have lent first. And so there maybe is not as much of a disincentive to be lending and tipping the consumer over the edge. I think we obviously are all looking for a sustainable and competitive credit sector that is inclusive, fair, and supports small businesses. These are just building on what's already entrenched in the Credit Act itself. We'd be looking for a regulatory framework that supports, and this is a general consideration, it's not again specific to the debtor diminished interventions that have been proposed here, but I think we're looking for a regulatory framework which supports the rehabilitation of all borrowers. So not just the rich, not just the very poor, but all borrowers and across that spectrum. And we acknowledge that there may be different mechanisms that are needed in order to do so, but we need to have a solid view and a consistent view of how any borrower at any point along that spectrum can reasonably rehabilitate on an ongoing basis if they get themselves into trouble. And then maintaining financial stability is, I think, for us just it's a constant, whatever actions or interventions we take, we need to be managing our different policy objectives. So there's a question here around promoting consumer protection balanced against efficiencies and competition, balanced against financial inclusion, balanced against financial stability. And it's important that by achieving one of these objectives, we're not compromising another. So in other words, by achieving financial stability objectives, we shouldn't be so conservative that we actually land up infringing on financial inclusion or market conduct, which sometimes has been the case. But the flip side is also true as well. So we've thought a lot about, and this is a general question around, where is the cliff? So there have been discussions around consumers who are getting themselves, again, when consumers are getting over-indebted, the level of indebtedness varies. Again, there's a spectrum. So there's we can look at someone who has debt and is easily managing to service that debt. Then there is someone who might be struggling and they're having to rotate their payments. So they might pay one payment this month, they'll pay another payment, they'll pay make the payment on a different loan the next month, and so it goes. But overall, they've still got their head above water. Then there will be some points in time where actually that person starts struggling on more of their debt obligations and will be starting to miss. And then there's a point when they'll be starting to miss for months at a time. And then there's a point where actually all the majority of their loans or all of their loans are, for example, more than 9 months in arrears, and they're not able to make any payment, not just they're making some payments but not making the total. And so what we've been looking at and the research we will be coming back to present is trying to get a sense of where this cliff happens. Can we get a better understanding of what we can be using as an objective measure for the cliff? Because I think this also feeds into what our remedy will be. If someone is still earning an income and is making some payments but not all payments, they're under strain but can probably be rehabilitated through debt review. If, however, that person has got to the point where they are off the cliff, so to speak, that person will not be rehabilitated. Arguably could not. We're looking to see what point that person couldn't be rehabilitated through the debt review system. And then the question becomes, well, how do we help those people? And this isn't a question just for the lower income. Obviously, this is across the spectrum. But we're applying our lens here specifically to the lower income. And in terms of the bill, we've looked at below $7,500. So what we consider is the urgent need for clearly identified and specified unsecured debt obligations of consumers who cannot repay their debt to be permanently extinguished. There is a question around, and this is where things get a bit murky, around we support, I think that there's a separation here between people who have historically got themselves into trouble because the regulatory framework did not offer protection and did not prevent those people getting into trouble, and now they're sitting and they're off the cliff. They can't rehabilitate. Going forward, what we expect we're starting to see, and I think that the data, the research will hopefully give some further, will be giving some further insight here, is that the regulatory interventions which have already happened are starting to feed through. And we're starting to see, once you clear out what we could call that debt that can't be rehabilitated, the debt market is looking healthier on balance. So I think there's a question around, what do we want to do for the people who got their debt during difficult credit conditions and less regulatory protection versus now when it's become much more stringent? How do we deal with and the health of the credit market in general is looking better? How do we deal with those cases going forward? Which is not to say that there won't still be changes in economic circumstances or changes which still get people into trouble. Just to note, we appreciate the checks and balances which have been introduced into the bill, and I know that there's been some question around whether those are tight enough, but that's technical detail. Like, if we need to make them stronger, we can make them stronger, but I think in general it's important that those checks and balances have been considered. Maybe we need to beef them up, but that will be the technical work coming through. And welcome, of course, I think this is something which we strongly promote, is in line with wanting to support responsible borrowing going forward of those who have been rehabilitated, We need to change consumer behavior as well. And one of the ways to try and support that change in consumer behavior, responsible lending, is through financial literacy and budgeting skills, recognizing, however, that this actually can't be a once-off thing. For financial education to be effective, it's got to be an ongoing intervention. And so I think there are questions around how best to do that, but the principle we definitely support. So setting the scene a bit, this is just some high-level observations. What we've seen is that the total indebtedness measured as a percentage of disposable income is declining. So it was 85.7% in 2008 to 72% in 2017. We can still have a discussion of whether that's too high or not and how much it should come down, but at least it's on the right trend. However, what we note is that this masks large differences in the total indebtedness of individual households and indeed the categories of consumer. And this highlights the need for relief in targeted segments. We note, and this is some of the work that we've been doing internally, so this is not related to the work that we've contracted to have done for us, this has been internal treasury work, that the credit granted to borrowers earning less than 7,500 has fallen about a quarter between, so if we look at the periods between 2007 to 2013 and then the periods 2014 to 2017, there's been already been a big fall off in credit extension for this category. So that leads to questions around why. But I think one of the more heated topics, which I have over the course of the hearings, has been what would be the potential impact of further interventions on this income category, and will it have the effect of changing the composition of the debt market and the way that lending happens, and particularly what one would expect potentially is reduced lending or higher cost. And I know that there has been discussion around whether that's fair or not fair, and I'd suggest that it would probably be useful to have the Reserve Bank come and actually talk a bit about the credit market and how these changes happen. To understand the full chain and the mechanisms. And we'd welcome the opportunity to set that up. Just to note that while the credit granted to borrowers below that level it's not that there's been an overall decline in credit, and in fact that credit granted to borrowers above that has in fact increased over the same periods, respective periods. So I think this is the point where we're taking a step back. So this is not in our actual submission, and this is based more on our thinking around what's been the discussions that have been happening over the past week and longer. So we can ask ourselves, what is the problem that we're trying to solve? And I think you will recall, and I know that Barza referenced it in their submission. As you recall, we did that mapping exercise, where for a consumer who's getting themselves into trouble, where do they go? Yeah. And that would differ depending whether they've got an income, they don't have an income, or they've got assets, they don't have an asset. And what we did is we identified where we considered to be the main gaps. And reducing that down, I think that there were two main weaknesses which were observed. The first was weaknesses in the insolvency framework. So this is where you might have an income, you might even have assets, but the nature of your debt or the size of your debt relative to that means that you're actually insolvent and you're not going to be able to make good. It could also be a case that you have no income and no assets, but by definition you would then be insolvent. Okay. Sequestration currently does not work for NINAs, and then I focus on NINAs because that's been the focal point of these hearings and debate. So when we're talking about sequestration, where we talk about liquidation for companies who are insolvent, sequestration is talking about the equivalent. It's liquidation for individuals who are insolvent. We also observe that there's weaknesses in the debt review system such that we think it only, or what we've seen, is that it's working better for those South Africans with higher incomes relative to those with lower incomes. And at some point, it becomes unaffordable for, or could, unaffordable, I'm not sure whether for the debt counsellor or the borrower, the person entering into debt review. I must say that this is something that on the data we're needing to get checks on against, but I think the principle holds, whether it's 7,500 or whether it's 5,000. I think that the point being is that you, as a borrower, you may have an income. It might just not be high enough in order to get yourself through the debt review system. So if we acknowledge that, or we recognize that those are where the main weaknesses are, what would we then suggest needs to be repaired? So firstly, there are those who have some income. These are not people who are off the cliff completely. If you've got some income, it's more a case of rearranging your debt in some way, your debt payments in some way, that you are able to use your income to survive and at the same time be servicing your debt commitments. For those people, in principle, we believe the debt review system should accommodate them. And so we need to find a way that for those people, whether they're earning 3,000 Rand a month or 7,000 Rand a month or 10,000 or 20, if you're in that state, you are earning some income, you can survive. You can make payments on some of your debt obligations. The debt review system should be able to accommodate that. For those who are off the cliff, for those who are, have, I mean, we, the extreme being you've got no income, no assets, but there will be others. You have a little bit of income, some assets, even those might be off this cliff, and they are effectively insolvent. We acknowledge that the Insolvency Act needs to be repaired, and we acknowledge that revising the Insolvency Act is underway, but it's taken decades already. I know that it's been reprioritized. We are, together with the DTR, working in that process. That's the longer-term solution. But what do we do now? And I think that's the question to highlight. So how do we prioritize and accelerate this, in effect, sequestration without necessarily relying on the Insolvency Act, which is going to take some time to come through? So we ask these big questions of ourselves. What does the draft bill do? What does it not do? What do we think it's not doing? What do we think it's aiming to do? And what could it do? So in terms of what we think it does, it provides very clearly once-off and immediate relief for NINAs. And just to qualify, this is not an assessment of the technical detail of the bill. This is the big picture view, as I said. We'll get to the technical detail. So what is the draft bill we think it does? It provides once-off and immediate relief for NINAs. It does give future relief in terms of the new Section 88F, but this is less certain and it's less systematic, and I think there's been a lot of discussion around how that could happen in future. What do we think it does not do? We don't think that it systematically addresses the situation where a South African is insolvent. So this point about the sequestration, it's not doing that currently. And I'm not saying it was intended to do that. We're just observing against what we've identified to be the problem, so I should also just qualify that. It also does not make improvements to debt review, and it does not differentiate between someone, or we don't think it differentiates between someone who cannot rehabilitate because they cannot access debt review versus insolvency. So it's not making that distinction. What do we believe it's aiming to do? Bring relief to the poorest of the poor now and in future. What could it do? And I think this is the important point for us, is I think where we could be building on, there's the opportunity to build on the bill in its current form, is that in addition to what's been, or alongside some of what has already been put forward, is to repair with the gaps in and leverage debt review and as it currently fits. How can we make it work better across the spectrum? And there has been discussion on this. And this really becomes, I think, it comes down to a funding issue. Firstly, well, there's two issues. Firstly, there's a systems issue that the DCRS needs to be adjusted so that it can accommodate this full spectrum. And secondly, it's funding. Who's going to pay for these people who need to go into debt review? But I think those, if we identify that this is what we want to do, I think that can be, those are technical details which can be negotiated and resolved. I think the second thing which it could do is be giving immediate relief to the poorest of the poor, which is the debt intervention that's already been contemplated, the immediate relief. And I think it could introduce a limited version of sequestration, because it's already kind of going in that direction. The only thing is it identifies specific categories of persons which may be identified in future. We could think about actually having a more systematic approach, which is if you are, depending on how we define this on the technical, if you are someone who doesn't have, who has insufficient assets and insufficient income, and you are in effect off the cliff, you are in effect insolvent, how can we through a process offer sequestration? And basically it would be the extinguishing of your debt and a fresh start. The distinction would be in terms of jurisdiction, and as far as we understand, but this would need to be further unpacked as well, is the reach of that would be limited. That the reach of that would be limited to credit providers. So it's not all your debt. What sequestration would normally do, if it was under the Insolvency Act, it would be an extinguishing of all your debt. So there's been a lot of discussion around municipal debt, for example. This would not touch that. This would touch debt of credit that's related to credit providers. I think what's important here is that we can see this as a trajectory. That this is something we could actually do now, acknowledging that the Insolvency Act work is underway. We are participating in that. And this could then feed into the Insolvency Act work, and in fact could ultimately, when the Insolvency Act is eventually completed, it would then take over from this. This is, would be a stepping stone, as it were. But I think it's an important one. So going back now to the more technical detail and looking at the bill in its current form, I think one of the issues the questions remaining for us is the potential impact on the broader social economy. From our side, we are doing the research on the direct impact on credit providers, but that's obviously only one piece. So there is a question around the banking sector. I have put this as a question mark. I think what's coming through is the size of the debt that's being suggested that would in effect be extinguished would not have a systemic impact. And I'm saying this cautiously because I think we need to, and what we'll be doing with the committee is unpacking fully the committee, and also this is something which we would need to engage further with the Reserve Bank and also the banking sector in general. That doesn't mean to say that there won't be impacts on the banking sector. So in other words, if the sector takes a knock on particular segments, there might be an impact on the composition of the market as a whole. And that we would need to look at going forward, and we'll try and anticipate what that might be. The retail sector we also think would be heavily impacted. And the retail sector is a meaningful contributor to GDP and employment. Again, I think that's something which would need to be engaged with the retail sector specifically on what exactly this would mean for them. Is there a potential impact on tax revenue? There will be an impact. The impact will differ, and this is the aggregate impact, would differ depending on how credit providers have been dealing with their non-performing loans currently. So in other words, have they written them down? Haven't they? How are they accounting for them? So this is also something which, when looking at the banking sector, we would need to consider. So in other words, when we look at the banking sector, we look at it as a, will this have a substantive effect on you, yes or no? We think no in the short term, maybe over the longer term, and maybe over the composition of the debt market. Will there be any other impacts? Probably yes, because of the way that these things are accounted for. And there might be knock-on effects in terms of the capital that they have to hold against, etc., in terms of their regulatory requirements. And then I think this is the issue which I had raised, where I really think that there would be value in getting the Reserve Bank to come and speak about, is looking at the potential impact. on the volume and the cost of credit, and the structure and composition of the debt market. So in other words, if an intervention is applied universally on micro, say for example, it's a $5 billion, and this is a completely random figure, I'm making this figure up, so please do not quote me on this. Say there's a $5 billion hit on both banks and micro lenders. What that means is, arguably, banks will weather that more than micro lenders. What does that mean? It means that actually the composition of the debt market means that the banks will survive, a lot of the micro lenders might not. What does that mean? It means that if you look at the overall composition of the debt market, it will strengthen the position of banks relative to micro lenders. This is a hypothetical scenario. I'm just saying these are the things which we need to think through. So we've spoken about some of the reforms that are underway. Broadly speaking, there's two sets of reforms. Firstly, there's Twin Peaks, and secondly, there's the reforms that relate to the credit market specifically. So under Twin Peaks, what we are looking to do is streamline and harmonize the regulation and supervision across financial institutions, and that's well underway. We're looking to be establishing our regulators in the first half of this year, hopefully 1 April. April Fools, yes. And those are... The FSB in particular has already been taking strong steps in order to be migrating into this far stronger market conduct consumer protection agency. The retail credit sector, on the other hand, I think you're all probably well versed with, there's been a lot done, from the affordability criteria, suitability criteria, interest rate caps, credit insurance, focus on EAOs, the DOJ, DTI, National Treasury, we've all been involved in significantly strengthening the regulatory framework for the way in which credit is issued and collected on. Now, the reason why I'm highlighting this is exactly the point that I'd made in the beginning, is we must also, we acknowledge that there is a lot of work that's been done, which we will only be seeing the full effects on now. So, this again is relevant for what do we do for the people who are already in trouble versus in future, do we think that we will need the same radical interventions going forward? We have referenced the international examples, and this is specifically in reference to the new clause 88F, which are the regulation powers. And we are concerned with the what we see as being that the new 88F goes beyond what has been contemplated in these various examples. So Croatia, for example, and the main differences here is that either it was that the interventions, the debt extinguishing, if I can call it that, the main difference is either it's in primary legislation and it goes through that extreme process, or it's actually government debt. So where it was more, where there is a softer process in terms of writing it off, it was actually government's debt to write off in the first place. So you're not impacting on private rights. So Croatia, for example, was a once-off measure. It was a measure agreed between the passed by Parliament. India, announced by Minister and subject to Cabinet approval. The USA, it applied to federal loans, i.e. government loans. And then the others, the New Zealand, USA, UK examples, these were vary between being the NINA scenarios, bankruptcy, reckless lending provisions. These were all contained in the primary, codified in the primary legislation and passed by Parliament as well. So as I said, we do have some concerns with the current version of the bill, and particularly as relates to 88F. We believe that this introduces a significant level of uncertainty for credit providers. We have concerns that it compels credit providers to act as insurers, which in terms of the current regulatory framework, we don't think is doable. There are questions around whether it may, in future, could it have an impact, or the nature of the impact on the retail sector and the banking sector. And as I said, it does seem to go beyond the international examples, as I've just described. It may also be unconstitutional. This is more in general. We think that there remain some issues, some clauses within the bill that may be unconstitutional. We are getting our an opinion on this version of the bill, which we will be able to give, which we'll be able to present on as well, and we can do that when we're presenting on our research. And then, of course, I think what I've already alluded to, there's just a lot of unknowns in terms of impact, which is not to say that those unknowns can't be it's not to say that we can't get an assessment of them and at least take steps to mitigate, but I think it's still an important process to go through to say, well, what exactly do we know about impact? What don't we know? So it's not to say that because there are these unknowns, we shouldn't do it, but it's to say that I think that it's important to do a full assessment, a socioeconomic impact assessment on whatever the final proposals land up being, in order so that we can have an understanding on the ramifications, the broader ramifications. Some additional drafting recommendations. I think what will be very important is an effective and solid communication strategy, so that whether you are a borrower or in fact a credit provider, you have a clear idea of where you fit into the system, and particularly for borrowers, whether this applies to you, whether it doesn't. We have to be very careful of expectations. I know that even with the previous amnesty, there was rumors around, well, you're going to have your debt written off. That wasn't the case, but that becomes the expectation. So it's communications become imperative to make sure that this is effective. Currently, the implementation process, and there has been some discussion around this as well, it seems like, I think it's right, if we look at it from a purist perspective, it makes complete sense. But when you think about how this is all going to happen in practice, I'm just wondering how it could possibly be streamlined and simplified. So this is if for someone who is applied a debt intervention applicant, how that process is going to happen. If we are talking about in the realms of millions potentially of borrowers coming through the system, and we know that there will be a huge expectation that if this has been announced, and there will be a big fanfare, however this is finalised, there will be fanfare around it, and probably rightly so. But what that means is, there's going to be expectations, and those expectations will be from day zero. And so the question then becomes not only the communication strategy about to try and manage those expectations, but what you don't want are 2 million people who are trying to access this debt intervention, and the system just completely clogs and they can't get it, because that will create a second round of problems which we will then have to try and manage and rather be preventing. I think we would also propose and prefer that there's a lot that the bill implies, but it doesn't necessarily state. So one of those is the once-only principle. The other, which we speak to, is around the basis for qualification of debt relief. In other words, if you meet the criteria of earning less than $7,500 and you've got accumulated debt of less than $50,000. Sorry, I'm just checking these numbers. The issue being is, do you want anyone who fits the parameters to fall into the net, or do you actually need to prove that you are over-indebted? The bill implies that you have to prove that you are over-indebted, because it does provide for, in making the assessment, that the tribunal can make varied orders. But it doesn't explicitly state that, and I think it's important to do so. We're also thinking about whether, along the spectrum, to think about less than $3,500 or different categories, and that would depend on how we're actually going to treat the basis for qualification of debt relief. And I've already spoken about what we think is the importance of a socioeconomic impact assessment, and that in particular we think would be very usefully done between the DTR, National Treasury, and the Department of Justice, given the various impacts involved, which could be reviewed as per the existing process by the Department of Planning, Monitoring and Evaluation. So returning to the big picture then, I think, as we've stated, we are in support of this bill, and we think that we do agree that something definitely needs to be done, especially for those people which we see are actually off the cliff, as it were. And these are people who were taking on debt over a time when the credit market didn't have as much protection as it now does have. And we are seeing borrowers with loans of greater than 9 months who are not paying. Now, there's a question I think we can safely say, if you haven't been paying your debt for 9 months, you're likely that, and you are earning less than $3,500, less than $7,500, you are likely to not suddenly start paying your debt now. So there's a definite need for this. The question is how. So we're asking whether we can explore ways to build on the current bill, firstly to give the most needed relief to the NINAs, as has been described, both now but also in future in a systematic way that is solidly constitutional. And the way that I've proposed this earlier is to think of being a limited version of sequestration. We could consider how this could feed into the review of the Insolvency Act, which we, as I've said, we already are involved with. And then how can we strengthen the debt review mechanism to effectively deal with those earning less than 7,500 rand a month? Now, I've just had someone representing the PDA saying that the 7,500 figure is not correct, and actually debt review works for people below 7,500. I think we can argue over the numbers, but ultimately what we can assert as a principle is that what we would want is debt relief. If you're earning an income, debt relief should be able to work for you, I think, as a principle. And currently we think, and we will present our numbers, but we're going to check with the PDAs, that this is the figure where we think it's not working. In fact, we've got other indications that it's higher than that, that actually it's 10,000. But the point being, it should work. If you're earning an income and you're able to be paying for your necessities, you should be able to enter the debt review system, because that's what's there and that's what it's designed to do. We think that these steps support the vision as we had outlined in slide 3 and reinforce the key principle that a borrower who can pay should pay. And then I suppose this raises the question that if we can find a systematic way, if we can introduce this limited sequestration or some version of it, does that mean, do we still need the Section 88F? So there is a question around what 88F is trying to achieve, and can we try and is this an alternative way to achieve that? So in conclusion, just to say again, thank you very much for the opportunity to present. I think the process that we went through with Twin Peaks, and in terms of moving towards setting up our new agencies, is that we found that so much of the learning comes not actually in the actual implementation, but in the getting us there, and that it forces us to really delve into complicated and complicated issues, which sometimes we have a tendency to try and avoid, and I really see that that's what's happening here. We're all being compelled to come and look at this much more closely and say, how can we make it better? So we look forward to further engagement, and I think in particular we'd like to engage on what we proposed around being this big picture. And I don't think that the bill is far away from achieving these things in terms of what we proposed. I think that with some tweaking, we could work to improve it. I know that there also has been already, for example, drafting done in terms of the insolvency process, particularly related to sequestration. So we could even leverage off some of that and bring it in and see what we can work with. We'd also welcome the opportunity to come and present on our research. It has been concluded. However, since we are just now running the numbers, we are cross-checking, because now we're seeing BARS is presenting, PDAs are coming up with numbers, so we're needing to at least make sure that we've ticked all those boxes. And as I said already, our senior counsel opinion on constitutionality on this version of the bill is forthcoming, and we can present on that as well. So thank you very much.
Well, we must thank you, Ms. Gibson, and your team. Let me formally introduce them. I see it's Ms. Lerato Malloy, Manager Regulatory Advocacy. Who is Malalo Mamburu, Economist? Right now, who's the person sitting next to you?
Good
sleep, but in a container.
Look, the three of you sitting there, it really is appreciated, and it just shows that because we have developed the synergy working together on this challenge, there's been a better understanding probably at National Treasury from the, what we're trying to achieve, but also your very constructive criticism as to where we're not doing this effectively and what we may still consider. And one does agree with you, we've had an, as you know, justice, etc. here, and they couldn't be here for the reason I indicated. A colleague fell ill on the plane, but we are working closely with them, and they have been very, very constructive in getting certain pieces of legislation and regulation already amended, as you know. So we'll certainly take that advice and the one about Saab. But before that you engage directly with all the members of the committee, perhaps you could just look at that point, because it has come up a couple of times. It may be unconstitutional given the impact on contractual relations and the implied deprivation of rights, especially in the new Section 88F. We're not saying that you should unpack this for half an hour, but just to give us your thoughts, because I know that you're going to be working and engaging with us further. So if you could do that, and then I'll take the committee's hands.
Okay, I must confess I'm loath to even try and answer this question, because I'm not a lawyer. And so I don't have the technical background. What I understand is this is coming down to a question between what are the rights, whose rights are being removed, what is the process by which those rights are being removed, are there mitigating circumstances which make the removal okay, and are there additional ways to be achieving what you're trying to achieve besides this, which means that this actually isn't as necessary as it otherwise could be. So I think those are some of the issues which are being contemplated. The legal opinion will get into the nitty-gritty as to exactly, because I think whether you're looking at, you could be applying that lens. I mean, what we see, broadly speaking, is there's the three levels. There's the immediate relief, if we can call it that, which is much more clearly articulated and defined, although maybe even there could be more clearly defined. Then there's the 88F generally, which is much more open-ended and could be thought to be, this is a bit more of a legal term, it's not my term, arbitrary, insofar as why would the minister choose one industry over another industry to get the relief, for example. And then there is a particular clause, it's a sub-clause within 88F, which actually the powers are then extended much wider. And it says, notwithstanding all the processes that and the limitations of 88F, the minister can in fact issue regulations on something wider than that, provided they, I think, then get the approval of the National Assembly. So it's even wider. So those would be, I think, in general, the three levels applying, as I said, that lens.
Thank you. Yes, your colleague there, Sir Party, is at Nekondela. Thank you. You're a director in National Treasury. Right. Members, just for the record, we do have others here, but we'll mention them a little bit later. On my left, then, can members raise their hands? Honourable Williams, Honourable Kachalia, Honourable Mantash, in that. Is that Honourable Tierko? Right.
Thank you, Chair. I've just got one question and one comment on the presentation. When Treasury says we support or we don't support sections of the bill, who is this we that we're talking about, and where did they get their mandate from? I ask this because your input is very similar to that of BASA and the other financial service providers, And my comment is, for me, the National Treasury doesn't sound like a treasury of the people, of a people-centered developmental state. And so I'm a bit concerned where your inputs are exactly the same as the banking sector, and there's not a lot of emphasis put on the benefit to the poor. And I'm a bit disappointed by that, but I mean, I'm used to it now because I've dealt with Treasury before. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Kechalia.
Thank you. I have a couple of questions. Thank you, Ms. Gibson, and your colleagues for presenting. I found your presentation to be of particular value, and I think adds to the discussion in no uncertain terms. Some issues of clarification. You said, when you spoke to slide 10, you said that the size of the debt to be extinguished will not have a systemic effect, but then went on to say, to talk to the effect on the retail sector, on the fiscus to reduce revenue, and on a general impact on the volume and cost of credit. Now, these, I'd be interested to know, we'd be interested, I'm sure, what how you unpack this in terms of effect, what constitutes systemic and what does not constitute systemic, and so that we can quantify this very really. That's a segue into the social and economic impact assessment, which you talked about, which is absolutely necessary and we need to see. Now, that has been concluded in many ways, you know, can we have some headline news about it, and when can we see it? Also, in terms of this assessment and the sort of interdepartmental froing of this, how will that affect timelines as regards the bill? Because I think that's also important. The other area I want to refer to is your international examples. I think it's absolutely crucial that that we look at these, and in particular the one from India caught my attention, where the banks were reimbursed in full by the Indian government so that it did not amount to deprivation of the creditor's property. Now this underscores the oft-stated thing that, you know, that there's no free lunch and there's no tooth fairy. Somebody has to pay for this. And let's understand that and what the implications of this, because in some people's minds this is often lost. And it also speaks to the constitutional issue, which the chairman spoke about, as to what constitutes legal property. I think these are terribly important. The other question I wanted to ask was, in terms of the retail sector, I think it might need some clarity on the status of micro lenders, because many of these are small retail businesses. They're not banks working with deposits and the like. So can you provide some clarity on that classification? Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Kachalia, Honourable Mantash.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just a few comments. First, I think the presentation from Treasury emphasized the point saying that the committee should have gone for a study tour in the first place. I'm saying the presentation by Treasury emphasizes a point that it was necessary for this committee to go on a study tour to make comparison of how other countries have handled the matter. And I hope this will go back and convince the chair of chairs. Yeah. Not that we want to travel, but it is necessary. And it's I would have loved the Ms. Gibson or Treasury to clarify the statement that says the proposals on the bill go beyond international practice. If that could be specified so that we can, you know, be better placed to correct the status. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honourable Tiaka, I'm just saying this for all members, even the presenters today and all the members, I'm not sure if there's something wrong with the mics, but it is much lower than yesterday. Honourable Tiaka.
Thanks, Chair. I'm of a view of Honourable, my colleague here, Williams, to say I'm also disappointed on Treasury. We are busy with them with this bill, but it looks like they are comfortable with the situation on the ground for people to keep on continuing being on those living spaces that they are now, because we really need to take them out of debt. It's like they're defending this market, and the how part, how do we address the issue, all of us, they're not coming on board. So also the section that they are concerned about, 88F, because she's saying she's not legally, can we get the legal team from Treasury to come and address us on that part, to say what is their take on that and how best can we craft that section to best suit everybody on that item. Also, she must also come on the page 10 on the, I think it's bulletin number 3, where she's talking about page 10, yeah, on the presentation, when she's saying how they expect, she can elaborate more on this reduced tax revenue, or should we engage with the SARS on how best can we address this issue, all of us, because really we have to assist our people on the ground. It's not fair that those who are rich will continue being rich, those who are poor will continue being poor. So this is not our mandate, to come and save the one side and not to address all people of South Africa.
Yes, I think the tax issue, to get further explanation there, will be very helpful. Just in terms of the Treasury, I thought there were one or two areas where, in fact, I was pleased to hear what they said, because I thought it did agree with us. They have on page 9, what is it aiming to do, meaning this bill of ours, the committee bill. And it makes it very clear, bring relief to the poorest of the poor, now and in the future. And I was very pleased to hear that that was clearly understood by National Treasury. I thought that was important, because that is a critical principle, which not every presenter has agreed with, you see. But I take the point that has been made in other areas by members, including yourself, and that must be loud and clear. The other point that I heard with interest from National Treasury on page 19, you know, about strengthening the debt review mechanism, and let's leave the figure alone for the moment, and the point made that debt relief should work for everyone earning an income. And it is something that indeed, as a committee, we will have to consider along our journey, but more specifically, the National Credit Regulator and, of course, DTI. Should everyone, because there is going to be a national minimum wage, remember, should everyone then be able to be addressed by this process? That's something I think that has to be considered. It is not for now, because right now it's not going to help. As we talk, we need to do something. So that's a point in question. The other issue was with reference to sequestration, and we were informed last year that they would be busy on this, but they made it clear this would not be ready probably until mid-year this year, you know, that kind of thing. But meanwhile, they have amended certain legislation, as we all know, and you're quite right to see this, if you like, the one of the measures to some extent is a limited form of sequestration, and we need to unpack that. And I think the point made by a member about the constitutional, the legal sides, and how Treasury sees that is going to be very, very important for us. It's going to assist us. So over to you then, Ms. Gibson, and your team.
Thank you very much. Now, I think I should start by saying that the proposals I've just made, I don't think are out of line with what you're wanting to achieve. So this is specifically about the question that we're not coming in favour of the poor and we're not supporting the process. So let me be more specific. Firstly, what we're saying is that for those people that qualify for immediate relief, we think they should get it. We can have some conversation around how and what the parameters are in the process, but that's the technical detail. The principle is, should we identify a group of people who qualify for immediate relief, and we say yes. Then there's the question around going forward. And the going forward, as it's been proposed, so that's one part of the bill. 88F deals with what if there's problems for people in the future? What about those people? We're saying, yes, we agree that's a problem. We agree that that's a challenge. This is one way of remedying it, is to propose the regulations. But you are going to help those specific people that might be captured there. And it's not systematic. What about a way which does that, but actually does more? And the does that and does more is when we're talking about the limited sequestration and getting the debt review to work all the way down. Because then you are reaching not just the people in that list, you're reaching everyone, which also has been one of the issues which has come up here. Why are we only helping those people? Actually, if you can't afford to pay your debt, yes, it's critical for the poorest of the poor, but there are many in the middle income, in the middle classes, if we can call it that, who are also really, really struggling, and they kind of fall in between the cracks. So if we could think of this, the way it's been proposed, the interventions as they've been proposed, are already almost a form of sequestration. The once-off relief that's been proposed is that. We're just saying, can we think of a way to apply that going forward in a systematic way that could be accessible to everyone, be it the poorest of the poor, as well as others who get themselves into the same trouble. When we're talking about when I've raised the constitutionality issues, again, I'm not saying these are anti-constitutional, therefore let's cut the whole thing. What I'm saying is we need to acknowledge that there might be challenges here, and therefore we need to acknowledge what those are, and then let's see how we can, if we focus back on the big picture and what we're trying to achieve, how can we ensure that the bill meets constitutional muster. So it's a process we go through as well. We test our own legislation for constitutionality. We get tested on our own tested on our legislation for constitutionality, and then we work and work and work to make sure that it meets that muster. And I think that's an important process. Getting then back to the specific questions. So Honourable Member Kotralia, on the slide 10 on the question of impact, we haven't done this exercise. So what we've done is look at the impact specifically on credit providers. What we've said is that for government, when we're introducing legislation, it's now become best practice and it's required on us to do a wider socioeconomic impact assessment. What I'd flagged there were some of the issues which might need to be taken into account if you were to do a broader impact assessment. Those might be the impact on, you know, on employment of those specific sectors, on tax, on whatever those other elements might be. There might not be a significant impact, but we don't know is the question, is the point. I think a study tour, I would support that as well. Our committee on finance did a study tour over the Twin Peaks review process, and I think it helped the committee a lot. So if you can if that is available to you, I think it would be very useful. The way that we set ours up is we also had a technical person that went along with the committee to support the committee and in understanding some of the technical issues where they needed, and I think that was also very beneficial and make sure that they could give advice where helpful as well. So I'd missed a question on the status of microlenders and the retail sector. There's 2 points here. Firstly, insofar as microlenders are credit providers, we have broken up those segments in terms of our assessment of looking at impact. In terms of the broader socioeconomic, they would obviously need to be incorporated as a category under there, but those would be knock-on effects. In other words, what we're looking at is to say, this is the number of loans and the volume or the amount of debt held by banks or microlenders or retailers. We've done that part. What that would actually mean for the bank or the retailer or the microlender, that would be the next part, but we haven't looked at that. That's the broader impact assessment. In terms of our legal team, I think they've already made, and whether we can get the legal team here, I mean, I think that's open, and I've already made the point that by raising some of these questions, it's not to say that we shouldn't do the bill, we're saying which parts of the bill can we strengthen and tighten. And I think that the same with SARS, that would form part, SARS is just one of the questions, and it would be forming part of that broader, who does this impact, who should we speak to, what does it actually mean, and I think that would be an important process to go through. And then Chair, I think you had raised the question around should everyone be addressed by the review and the limited sequestration. I think that's just going to the point that I've already made, which I think we're almost there, and we've done so much work has got us there. If we could just apply a slightly different lens and say, if this is something we want to do, I mean, even if you were to say, even if you gave us the opportunity to make or the DTI to make proposals in this regard, I mean, the DTI would be better placed to make proposals around debt review, for example. I think it would be very useful for us to get that direction. And on us, I think we could be specifically giving inputs on a limited sequestration. We'd be able to make specific proposals that maybe could guide you and say, well, would this work, could it work? So thank you very much.
No, fine, thank you. I did note on your page 20 of the PowerPoint where you do state that senior counsel, of course, that's the legal people, their opinion on constitutionality is forthcoming. So you have already begun to access that, and you'll be able to come back on that point, because I think that's going to help us very constructively as well. But thank you very much, and also for ensuring that your team, one way or the other, is represented here during the public hearings daily. Thank you. Members, just while we are going to take the change over and the presentation by the Department of Trade and Industry, allow me to point out the members of National Consumer Tribunal, Professor Joseph Maseko. We note you have also been here daily during these inquiries. Ms. Morales, she was here yesterday. Then we have on the other side the National Credit Regulator. We've already noted Ms. Nomsa Machigari, the Chief Executive Officer. Mr. Obed Tongwani, Deputy Chief Executive Officer. Thank you. Both of you have been here every day, as well as the Senior Legal Advisor. That's Ms. Nupeng or whatever? Ingabeni, Ms. Ingabeni, is that right, NCR, and that's all that we have there from the National Credit Regulator, would that be correct? Because I see something here called credit law or something, no, that's correct, right. And then from the DTI, we have already acknowledged the Acting DDG, Mr. Nyetse Kenzie, Mr. Sipa Mangla Kumkani, acting chief director, also from CCRD. But what we ought to point out is we did get your apology on the first day because you were held up there in Pretoria on another matter. So we did get that, and Mr. Sipa Mangla was present here. So we do have you all here with us today. And depending on how long this input is, we may have time to put in 5 minutes of the Credit Bureau or so, in the, or 10 minutes, in the absence of justice that was here today. So let us to immediately move forward to the presentation by the Department of Trade and Industry. For those of you who this is a fairly new experience, the way that public hearings work is that there are several public hearings, as it were, and in between the department of whichever department it is, in this case trade and industry, makes comments along the way. But these are not their final, this is not their final position. It is constant, it's a dynamic position, which to some extent is also informed by the public hearings themselves. Thank you very much, Professor, also for being here. Thank you. So, if you can let us know who's going to speak, etc., do go ahead.
No, thanks, Chair, honourable members and colleagues. I will be doing the presentation. My colleagues will be supporting me. I'm with the professor here. In certain areas, I may have to pause and he takes over depending on the issues. But by...
Let me just correct this. The content specialist is Ms. Sheldon. Has just pointed this out. It's not a comment on public hearings you've heard. You are busy informing yourself. But in fact, it is a direct comment, the same as anyone else here. It's a direct comment on what is a committee bill. This is not a bill that came from trade and industry. And it is the only bill this committee has done as a committee in the last 7 years, 8 years. We've had a private member's bill, but not a committee bill. So they are justified, and it's quite valid that they should comment on what is a committee bill.
No, thanks. I was still going to say that we are invited to comment on the bill, no longer questioning the policy. The policy stage we have passed. So we have a bill in front of us, and there are public comments. We may, in passing, comment on public comment in passing, but we are commenting on the clauses of the bill so that we take the process forward. By way of introduction, we welcome to be given the opportunity to comment on the bill. We also would like to appreciate the presence of the NCR, the NCT, Professor Maseko, Nomsa Mosehari, and then my colleagues from the DTI in making this presentation. This one is in the bill and also in the comment. The issue of constitutionality, we are saying it will be better to argue and do the crafting properly in order to be in compliance with the Constitution. But there are many views about this Constitution of the Republic. There are many views. We should not be confused and think only one person can arrogate the power to say, I am now a constitutional court. We are saying this because there is a process, according to our knowledge, that when the bill
is now finalized, we need maybe to take it to the president, which is a route to go for signing to be an act of parliament. What can the president do when the bill is in front of him or her? Can do the following three things. One, can sign the bill to be an act of parliament, because the president is convinced that it has passed the constitutional muster. Or the president can say, I'm not satisfied in this area constitutionally, I'm returning the bill back to parliament to consider the following. He may state the reasons. Three, can refer the bill to the Constitutional Court for certification. To say, Constitutional Court, please certify if it is passing this and that. The judges are not drafters, but they will indicate according to that processes. So we are saying these processes in order for us to assist. In order to assist that when we are tired of arguing about the constitutional issue imperatives, there are processes that the president can still do to assist the process to go ahead. Again, number two, we have this issue of saying it seems as if we are not going to respect the right to be heard when we take this process forward. Like when somebody comes with the issue of application on the debt relief, it seems as if an impression is being created that the credit providers won't even be invited to state their case. And then we are saying in pledge number two under the preamble, we recommend that the process of rule nisi, it should have been in italics, rule nisi, this is seemingly a Latin terminology, we will explain what it means. And then we are saying, therefore, when the intervention applications are made, interested parties having the opportunity, should have the opportunity to come and comment on the submission. That is the right to be heard. It's also in Latin. It should also have been in italics. Altrem partem rule. So this assertion of saying it seems as if we are coming with a decree, we are coming with arbitrariness, it is unconstitutional, and the like, at a point of entry, we are saying no. When there is that application, there should be that process, and therefore we should have passed the master, the constitutional master. The right to be heard, it won't be undermined. Three, it is recommended that the credit providers be allowed to make submissions to the NCR during application evaluation stage. It's just an emphasis of the point. It is recommended that the drafters from the relevant agencies, in other words, the DTI has got the drafters, we also have the NCR that has got their own drafters, NCT also have the legal people there. Therefore, taking the process forward, we are saying we are available to work with the parliamentary drafter and take the process forward and assist each other on the wording, critiquing the bill and the clauses. That's what we are saying. So now going, maybe if I may add the other issue before the commenting on the amendments specifically, is that whatever we are doing on this debt relief issue, we started by saying we work interdepartmentally. I just want to clarify the following point, that the Department of Justice has already approached Parliament to pass an act. It's called the Courts Laws Amendment Act. We were working together. They were behind us on garnishee orders, what should be done in the land. They have already concluded that matter. So the Department of Justice is also coming with another act that may complement what we are trying to do here, what Parliament is trying to do. The Debt Collectors Amendment Bill. It is already in the pipeline. Last year they reported to us that it is going to be concluded during the course of this year, maybe mid-year. So is the insolvency. Last year they reported to say it seems as if they are asking a lot of jurisdictional issues from Wales, if I'm not mistaken. So they are working in order to complement what the Parliament is trying to do. So we are going in tandem. They will come and talk for themselves, but I wanted to say government is being coordinated to one direction. So going now back to the issue of amendments, section 3, I will use section and clause interchangeably. The clause 3, we agree with clause 3. The circumstances to be taken into account to qualify for debt intervention for both consumers who are over indebtedness or in financial distress. So we agree with that crafting. The issue of financial distress, whether it should be defined or not, the team was of the view that maybe we should define what we mean by financial distress. But under the company law, when we deal with the issue of business risk, the expression is not defined. It is not defined. And then we are saying courts, different courts from different provinces, they are coming with different approaches, and then we are saying, let us not amend and define financial distress. Let us allow the courts to come with jurisprudence. And then one day it may go to Bloemfontein, and then one day it may go to the Constitutional Court, because the courts in their various provinces, they have different approaches, and it is allowed in law to allow the legal jurisprudence to emanate from the courts. So here we are saying maybe we should consider defining the expression financial distress. Agree with the clause H2A, the duty on credit providers to report suspected cases of reckless lending. During the public hearing, an impression was also being created that we should not introduce these penalties because we're dealing with business. Like in the Companies Act, during the amendments of the or reform of the Companies Act, we, as a department, we told Parliament that we are no longer going to introduce the bureaucracy for efficiency, if you don't come with this document, therefore you are taken out of the system, as an example, and therefore there is a penalty, you may have to pay a fine and the like. It was quoted as if we are going backwards by demanding that if affordability assessment, during the application of the affordability assessment, the credit provider see that there are issues that this person is overly indebted and therefore I'm going to refuse this. But you proceed and give a loan to that particular person, and then you don't suspect, whereas the rules are there. We are saying, please report suspect, and then if you don't do that, there may be a sort of a penalty. I think we support this section or clause, and then that issue of saying it seems as if we are going backwards, we are introducing penalties, whereas we are here to run businesses. We are saying we don't agree with that, because there are also instances where directors are declared delinquent directors by the courts because they are doing something that is not supposed to have been done. Or they register a company after doing things that are not in line with governance issues, they liquidate that company and form another one, so they hop from one place to another, then you can approach the court and declare that person a delinquent director. That is the punishment that is in the business environment. I'm just going a little bit sideways in order to say punishment are still there. And then we also say if they are doing that, the current Companies Act also has something what we call piercing the corporate veil. In other words, that director that is doing something so wrong beyond governance issues, therefore that director may have to be held personally liable. Personally liable. We call it piercing the corporate veil. So these are punishment. I'm justifying the issues of saying don't come with punishment. This act should be allowed, like the Companies Act, to say if an auditor is suspects something and does not report to the CIPC or to SARS or to NPA, to say, it seems as if there is money laundering, that auditor should go to IRBA. IRBA is an independent regulatory board of auditors, so that penalties should be imposed to that person. So I'm just justifying that this section or clause is well placed, and then I think we can go further on other issues. Section 88A, the definition of debt intervention applicant is supported. There is a definition. But there is no definition of debt intervention. So we are saying let's consider whether to define what is debt intervention. But there is a definition of debt intervention applicant. So let's consider, maybe we can come to the same conclusion of saying let's do this and that, but it already is covered. So there are also these issues of saying Section 88B, we are in favor, apology for the spelling, American favor, of keeping it internally within the NCR. It must be internally dealt with by the NCR. And therefore, if that is the case, we need to talk about capacity later, about the NCR. We must allow the NCR CEO to designate certain people, officials, to deal with those issues internally. Then there is also Section 88C. We support it, but we also support the issue of saying the single member can deal with the issue more efficiently. And then if people are not in agreement, the participants, that is the credit provider and the applicant, therefore there should be an appeal process to go to the three members. The three members then can also pass the judgment as the final conclusion based on what transpired with the single member. And then we think this will be an efficient process. And then Section 88C, 5, it is supported, and then we recommend the establishment of a specialized institution focusing on consumer education. Specialized institution focusing on consumer education. But we also secondly recommend that financial literacy education be added into the basic education curriculum. In other words, I should not start to meet these financial issues and then only when I'm working or at university. It must be done at a lower level. We are also talking to the issue of Section 88D to say maybe we may have to delete it, to delete certain areas to align the proposed Section 88B with consumers are no longer under the proposed Section 88B, being referred to debt counseling. So we can do the realignment during the drafting. So the other issue is that we support the rehabilitation in general, but propose that the manner and time frames be prescribed in regulations, and therefore there may be a need for realignment of the sections, and it should be done by, say, the CEO of NCR, not the minister. So, but we are just proposing, in this area, because efficiency of designation by the CEO instead of by the minister, it can be very efficient, but it's just a proposal. Yes, I think we dealt with certain sections. Therefore, the others that we didn't comment, it means that we are in agreement. But in conclusion, it is that the NCR, the NCT, and the DTI will support the bill in its entirety. And then we are seeing issues of socio-economic impact assessment will be an ongoing process during these stages, and then such a report will have to be placed before Parliament, and then they also take a decision in that regard. From my side, that was by way of conclusion, but as I said, the professor or Nomsa Mutsehari may want to emphasize certain points. Thanks, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. Did you wish to add, Professor Chair?
Thanks, Madam Chair.
That's the Chairperson of the National Consumer Tribunal. Thank you.
And honourable members. Chair, just to emphasize a few points, the main one being that which is introduced, which has never really existed before in any form in the country, the one about financial literacy education. I think we tend to look at that more at a cognitive level, where you're trying to teach the brain of a person how to calculate, how to budget, and all of that as a skill. But I think in our country it goes a little bit deeper than that. We think it should be some kind of an institution, whether it's within something like NCR or standalone, whatever the case may be, when the policy decision from the committee makes that determination. But it should be something that intervenes very heavily, like when we're combating HIV/AIDS, we had to be very robust and invest a lot of money in combating that, because this over-indebtedness in our country is more of a pandemic. It is not something you can just relinquish to some trainers to come and train you mentally in a course. It should go deeper, more into psychological counseling, more into rehabilitative penetration of the soul of the person, and not just leave it at the superficial level of knowing. Because the example we like to use is that of a medical doctor who knows how smoking, for instance, is bad for your lungs, but himself smokes, because he's now addicted to this. It's in his psyche, it's no longer in his head. The emotions override what you know. So the same with our over-indebtedness in the country, because we live to compete with the Mutsepes next door, since we don't have Joneses. And there was this one advert in the, I think it was ShopRite some years back, they were showing picnickers picnicking, buying boerewors. And the commentary was, they checked each other's boerewors to see who was the man, you know, between these two picnickers, two families. So each one walks and chats to the other one to look at his vors and compares it to his own vors to see between them who is the man. And we do that with our furniture, with our cars, with our houses. Yes, which means if you get a bigger income, you don't see that income as something that you can now have more money to invest and have money working for you. You see it as something to now show off. Because the problem with a house is, unlike a snail, you can't carry your house all over town like a car. So you have to now invite guests, 40 guests home every night, every Friday, so you can display the house. So it means the higher you earn, if you have this sickness, the more you will be over-indebted. And so then, that means it's not a question of knowledge, it's a question of feeling. It's a psychological thing. So we need an institution that will pioneer this at a level that it will be like when you're fighting AIDS, HIV/AIDS, that kind of thing, so that we exorcise that spirit out of our psyche as a society. Then we can start investing. We can get money and see it as an investment tool as much as we see it as a purchasing tool. At the moment, we see it only as a purchasing tool. And that is where the problem is. And it's happening at all levels. It's not just the underprivileged. It's just that they stand out quicker. It quickly bites them. But we probably, maybe 99% of us sitting in the room might be in that situation. Thank you.
Yes, this is the National Credit Regulator, Chief Executive Officer, Ms. Motshegari.
Thank you, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. I think the issue of NCR capacity must be taken seriously. Our staff now are seriously stretched. Remember, we are regulating a 1.7 trillion industry. So, you know, we would need to capacitate the NCR so that we can, you know, successfully implement this program. It's important that we make sure that, you know, there is efficiencies and you know, effectiveness in the way that this program is implemented. And that is why we are also saying we will need to build capacity in-house instead of outsourcing this function to other entities that are looking to profit, you know, from the program. But again, the issue of financial literacy is very, very important, and that has been also highlighted in our presentation. Remember, in schools now, what they have is a course around lifestyle orientation. The course is already there. It's just a matter of making sure that we piggyback on it. And that's why it's important to make sure that we instill this culture at primary level. We shouldn't even start at university, because we need to instill this culture at a very, very early age so that we build a culture, you know, over time. I think that's all we have for now. Thank you.
No. Yes, DDG.
No, thanks. Thanks, colleagues and the chairperson. So therefore, that is the end of our preliminary response to clauses. And then the clauses that we didn't talk to, therefore, it means that we agree with them. But we may have to sit with the parliamentary advisor. We propose that we have a team decide how to dovetail this team with the parliamentary drafter. It can be officiated at the committee's level. And then the issue of responding to the stakeholders is another issue, maybe on the 13th and the like. We will come with a detailed responses. Thanks.
Thank you very much for that. And as I said, you're always with us anyway, as long as this particular process is going on. But that was an interesting comment from Professor Joseph Maseko, the chairperson of the NCT. Indeed, you may well be right, that it is a form of addiction. But yes, we have to tackle it where we can, and we ourselves are not into the psychological field, although I may be personally, we're in the financial, but I think it is something to take account of, which members have spoken about. It's a behavioral issue. You yourselves have mentioned this. How do you change that? And we have said in the national, the transformation of the financial industry in the Standing Committee of Finance, that there was an urgent and great need for the financial sector to develop plans to encourage children to save, and the government, the state, to do likewise. It may be a bit late to tell a matriculant to start saving. You know, that's the time they've already learnt to spend. All right. Honourable Williams, Honourable Kachalia, in that order.
Thank you, Chairperson. I only have one question. Does the DTI think that there are any unconstitutional clauses within our bill, our draft bill? If so, which ones? And if not, could we have the legal opinion that says that you don't think there are any unconstitutional?
Thank you, Honourable Williams. Honourable Kachalia.
Thank you. And Deputy DG, in your conclusion, you say you refer to the drafting of the economic impact assessment studies, which you say will be enhanced through public comment. I'd like to gain an understanding of, because this is crucial. We need this. Otherwise, we don't know where we're going. So when will it be available? How? By whom? And importantly, what will be the details of the areas of assessment? And in terms of this, will the rule Nisi and the Audi Alteram Partem rule, which you referred to, allow for input to be applicable here in terms of inclusion, to the desired inclusion by the stakeholders into the areas of assessment that they may deem to be required? So I think that's particularly important from my point of view. I'd like to refer to the professor's remarks about psyche and exercising that spirit. In many ways, just an opinion of my own, that is, we're talking about the human condition here to a large degree, and we don't really want to tilt at windmills. I give you a little personal insight. I am here three generations later. My grandparents came in the 1870s to South Africa as a result of my family in India mortgaging their farmland to pay for a wedding of two daughters. As a result of that, my family came to South Africa, contributed to the economic, social, and political life for over 120 years, and that was a good thing, and they also paid off the debt in India. So these things happen.
Are there any other comments or questions? Yes, Honourable Buyani.
Uh, thanks very much. It's only a comment, Chair. I wanted to check, man, with the NCR specifically. Because throughout the presentation and the workshop and the hearing, stakeholders were crying about capacity and inability and so forth. I want to check directly from them as to they have identified that loophole, yeah. And in terms of how do they think they can be deal with their capacity, because it's very much disturbing to an institution like NCR to don't have a capacity to deal with issues. So I wanted to directly verify from them. Thanks, Chairperson.
Thank you. Just on this note of the cost and the capacity, members will recall that we have, when addressing the DTI budget, we have indicated that this was a challenge and that more resources should be considered, but that we were aware that the fiscus didn't have the funding at the time. So we asked for this as soon as the fiscus, you know, if there is no money, there is no money, you see. But as soon as there is, we asked for this to be urgently prioritized. But we may need to re-emphasize that point that you've made, Honorable Biani. Over to the three of you, that's the DTI, it is the National Consumer Tribunal and the National Credit Regulator.
No, thanks. On the issue of do we think there are constitutional issues, which clauses do you think maybe there are unconstitutional and the like? Reading our bill, really, we could not find such, but the debate that it seems as if when a debt is written off, extinguished, we may be expropriating somebody's property. This debate, we are participating in them, but sometimes we think we may need somebody coming from the financial sector to say, really, is this an asset? You know, this is not our area of competence, but the debates sometimes show that nobody's property is being expropriated, but others will say you are expropriating it. So therefore, we wouldn't like Parliament really to go without having resolved this, and we are here to assist. As for now, I wouldn't like to say this is this and that, but we appreciate those debates. And then we have ring-fenced it, and we are researching on it. We will come back in detail, maybe on the 13th going forward, whether we are expropriating people's funds. On the rule, Nisi, I will request the professor, because it's in practice. He will talk to it, but before that, maybe I can dispose this one of the impact assessment. Who will be doing that? When we started this process, when Parliament started the process of the bill, Parliament requested the DTR to assist in sort of coming with a policy understanding, which we did, and then also on that policy to come with the issue of impact assessment. That was done. And then we requested to be given further mandate, and then we are saying, therefore, we can improve on that impact assessment that was done from the policy perspective. Now we are at the bill stage. We should, the DTI, I'm putting it forward, should progress dealing that impact assessment study. I'm responding to who will be doing that. The participants, generally, when we deal with this issue, there are stakeholders. Sometimes these are not legal issues. the people who are having the competency on doing impact assessment. They call the stakeholders to say what will be the impact of this clause and the like. That will be done, including the rule NISI. But the rule NISI and the capacity, my colleagues will deal with that. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. Regarding, just still briefly on the property issue, the constitutionality of issues, I think the main misunderstanding is when we spoke about rule NISI, because people think that you will be making a swift decision, these temporary orders that we will have to issue, and then the credit provider is not represented. Because the committee decided as a policy imperative that we must not wait until the process is finished to come with a final ruling. We must start with a temporary one, which is then that rule NISI, which will arrest or suspend that type of repayment or demand of payment and give relief to the person temporarily until the matter has been debated fully in the tribunal, which we are in favor of because it's already happening. It's already being practiced in interdicts. When you apply for an interdict against a strike, in things of domestic abuse, you do have these rule NISIs in which temporary orders are issued out to say, don't come near 500 meters of this person until this date when we'll come and show why this order should not be made permanent. So it's already happening. It cannot be said to be unconstitutional. We are not inventing a new thing there, I think. It will meet first the imperative of the committee, its political concern that we must have relief instantly and not allow the credit provider to drag the process while this this disadvantaged consumer is being strung along and they are suffering. But at the same time, it doesn't take away the right of the credit provider to come and challenge that order being made permanent on the return date, which can be determined in the way forward as to how long will that be and so on. But they will be able to come and defend and fight to the death themselves to say, no, but this person is misleading the tribunal. This is the story as we know it, and they both fight it over through evidence. And then nothing is lost. With regard to the other part, which I think is our department, DTI, has just indicated of property deprivation, I think we can be assisted greatly. I'm tempted to refer to presentations we've just had, like the Treasury this morning, that I like their streaming of these things, to say stream these things that will be more about insolvency and separate them from those that will be more about over-indebtedness and so on and so forth, so that we have this partial insolvency, which is not going all the way, but it's relieving only on the credit aspect. That could sift it out for us nicely, so that in the end, those things that are more insolvency-based, they are not also taking away from people's constitutional property. Because when a person is insolvent, of course you have to release them. We already have that as a practice in greater insolvency. So this will be like a more toned, watered-down insolvency, the way it is proposed, if we would go that route. So I think that we will double-cross that bridge or cross it when we get to it. It's Leon Schuster. So remember.
Thank you.
No, ma'am, just a little bit. I think on the matter, the question that was raised by Honourable Member Mbuyane about the capacity, I was thinking that we should take that in a more robust approach, ma'am, because the issue of money should really first look at what we will achieve if we go the route, for instance, of capacitating the NCR. If we can give the NCR the enough power and resources to really fight this poverty thing and alleviate over-indebtedness. We will eliminate human trafficking, which is fueled by over-indebtedness to some degree. And we will eliminate hospitalization, because as we know that all 80% of the sicknesses we have in hospitals are psychosomatic. They are the mind worry telling the body to be sick. Yes, if we can eliminate all of those things that come down into the body generated in the mind, we can eliminate a lot of these sicknesses that we're suffering from. And we can eliminate criminality. Crime can also go down, because if a person has got self-esteem, because they are able to earn a living and date somebody that they like, they can, they don't have to commit a crime to show that they are the man. Yes, so I think there are those gains that will be hiding there, which means that temporarily at the beginning it might look like we are splashing out on capacitating this institution, but in the end the gains will eliminate a whole lot of other monies where stats will start coming down in those other growth areas of these problems, social problems. Thanks.
No, prevention is always less costly than dealing with the problems afterwards. We know that. But thank you for the input, Professor. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. We've been busy with is developing a plan around, you know, our needs in developing capacity at the NCR. So we just need to cost it so that at least we give DTI an idea of, you know, the requirements in terms of implementing this piece of legislation. Thank you.
No, thank you very much. So now there is a bit of a follow-up or comment. Honorable Kachalia.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Professor, for your clarification around the legal aspects and clearly in line with other legal principles, you know, justice delayed is justice denied, and your approach in that seems sound. But what's good for the goose must be good for the gander. So I want to refer you back to my original question, which was referring to the application to the Deputy DG of that rule nisi and audi alteram partem in terms of the impact assessment. So if stakeholders be able to say, we want these issues addressed, and in terms of rule nisi, unless they are addressed, this will not be complete, is what, so that's what I'm saying, there should be room for that in my submission.
Thank you, Honorable Kachalia. Honorable Buyani.
Thank you, Chair, once more. I'm not so sure because Mr. Masego is responding in terms of the empowerment and the staff complement. The question raised here was in terms of this hub thing, the data transmission hub, that their system cannot, they don't have that system in the process. And there's no turnaround time in terms of responding to referrals. So that is the thing that I wanted the clarity on that. And also programs that seeks to address, they said there's a school visit program that seeks to address credit awareness in the process. That is what I wanted to check. Thanks very much.
You shared that with us the other day, one of you, about the empowerment working with one of the NGOs or entities, yeah, in that regard. So that was really what this was being directed at. Do you want to comment further, or perhaps come, you know, in the next, give this to us in writing, possibly?
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I think all of that will be spelled out in the plan, because the plan will obviously have to include infrastructure development, and that talks to your ICT systems, talks to, you know, office space, and in the plan will also obviously include, you know, human capital.
Thank you, Honorable Mantar.
Chair, for me, the awareness campaign cannot wait for all such glamorous things. For instance, the NCR has visited my constituency and they have run a literacy program on debt and the rest and the likes, and the work they do for the people. So for me, it can continue whilst the rest of the glamorous things are being addressed. The awareness campaign to our constituencies can assist.
Very much, Honourable Mantash. Now, just a couple of points here. The reference to alignment is taken. I think it's very constructive. The other point about definitions here and there, for example, debt intervention, well taken as well. But on page 9, the reference to, you know, the prescribed in regulations. One must remember that will be the role of DTI, the secondary legislation, not our role as the committee. So certainly we agree with the principle that it needs to be prescribed. But thank you very much, the team there. You wanted to come in just quickly on DDG?
Yeah, no, thanks, yes. Honourable Kachalia. On that issue. When we do the impact assessment, generally there should be the scoping to say it seems as if these clauses are the major one, as an example. So it seems as if you are saying anything that has to do with the rural NEC, all those areas should also be assessed. So therefore, there will be participation at that time. That's as far as I can comment. And then the issue, we didn't want to brag on the issue of education and awareness that is taking place in the DTI, which consolidate, whether it's credit, consumer protection, intellectual property, you name them. That is happening. But what she's specific on is that she will come with this glamorous plan, time frame, yeah, and the money part of it will deal with that. But the other work is going on. No, thank you.
Right, thank you very much. It was simply because we, Justice, and constitutional development had that medical emergency, as you know, and that we've been able to save this extra time. But I was asked in the break if we didn't just have 5 to 7 minutes or so for the Credit Bureau to bring back here the issue that I'd asked them to do. And they say they can do this in that short time. So if we can do it, I don't know, what is the person's name, Mr. McGrath, Ms. McGrath, if you can please come to just the front. You've got that very short time, please, because there are a few other housekeeping issues I need to address.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. The issue that was raised, I think it was yesterday or the day before, was what data was held on the records of the Credit Bureau, and was it complete, was it going to assist, or what needed to be done to be able to effectively implement the debt intervention. Right now, there are approximately 450 credit providers providing data to the credit bureaus. There are in total 5,000 credit providers registered with the NCR. that will give you immediately some idea that not all credit providers are providing data to the Credit Bureau. In 2015, the DTI and NCR amended the NCA, particularly with relevance to Regulation 1913, which obliged all credit providers to give information to the Credit Bureau. That section was only became effective when the NCR last year in 2017 issued its guideline stipulating the manner and form in which the data must be provided. The NCR has also recently issued a guideline on fees. This is about a three-year project. Over the next 3 years, all the credit providers will be onboarded to be able to provide data to the credit bureaus, but right now that is not the case. So the situation for these people who we are talking about, who are earning under 7,500, are they going to the larger credit providers who are currently providing data to the Bureau? I'm not sure. Will you find that somebody comes or applies for debt intervention and they may on the Bureau reflect that they're not unable to pay some debts, but they may have another four credit providers that are not registered or they are not providing data to the credit bureaus. So this is all some of the issues that credit bureaus face.
I think it may be helpful, if this is possible, I wouldn't see any reason why not, where if you could give us a list of the 350 entities, companies, whatever, who are providing such information already. We don't want to know what information, just who is doing that. That, I think, could be helpful, and then we'll go to the National Credit Regulator to get a list of those that are registered.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We're actually working with the NCR on a daily basis to do this, because this is an industry initiative, so it's credit providers, credit bureaus, and the NCR. So all that information is available.
Thank you very much. I thought that was important for us as we move along in the public hearing. Thank you very much. Thank you to all of you who came in this morning and made a presentation to the committee. And I'm sure you appreciate that this is a dynamic exercise. You may even be hearing a few things yourself for the first time. And then remember the two committee secretaries, that's Mr. Medema and Mr. Hermans. You've got their emails. Should you wish to add, please do not hesitate to give us and furnish us with additional information. It is very important that we can get some constructive proposals. You don't think this is adequate. What do you think will be adequate? You know, that kind of thing. Now, that is going to help us produce the robust legislation. Now, coming, and thank you very much for yourselves. We would hope you would leave quietly if you have to run to the airport. Now, for the committee, just pointing out a couple of changes. Where's that program that was here? No. Right. We did issue this, and as I say, it was a draft a week ago. It had to be rejigged and then changed yet again. This, we believe, is what we discussed with the relevant committee members, meaning those chairing subcommittees. And we believe that this is in order. But as I said, it's become quite a dynamic issue, the program. There we have it here. You will notice that some changes have been made on the 6th of February. You see that there, the different people coming. Then we have the secretariat to meet on the bill. We're not meeting on the 8th and 9th. Do you note that, please? And then the 13th, the update on the status of the Copyright Amendment Bill. That bill is here with us. We had to recraft a lot of it, but we've asked the committee, the chairperson of the subcommittee on copyright, Ms. Honourable Tierco, to please brief us with the technical staff exactly what that status is per se, and she has kindly agreed to do that. Now, I'm sure if necessary you will make your own arrangements with the secretariat, etc. Then there is something in red here. That is not it's not for the committee per se. It is actually for the secretariat. Do you note that there? The one in red. Thursday. It's not our meeting per se. You know, the chair or the chairs of the subcommittees are welcome to go, but it's not a committee meeting. And then further on then you will get through to the end and note that on Wednesday, yes, you've got Human Rights Day on the 21st. The 22nd, the committee strategic planning workshop subject to approval. And then later on the 30th to the 2nd, the Easter weekend with constituency beginning on the 3rd to the 16th. Right. Now, there is one issue that we need just to address with a lot of members being new to the committee and sometimes even new to Parliament. Any time that you are going to not be here for a committee meeting, unless it is a medical emergency that you couldn't predict or a death in the family which you could not predict, including your own demise, then under any other circumstance a leave form must be signed. And the rule here is that a leave form is signed at least 3 days before working days so that the Chief Whip's office or the Chief Whip makes the final decision. When it comes to other parties here, not just the ANC, they have that arrangement in which when there is party business, they get permission from their Chief Whip in the same way that we do. And that is why you see this term party business when you're apologizing. All right? So when it's medical leave and you know you are going to be away, you're going to go in for an operation on a particular day or a dental or what, you know beforehand, that is not a day of leave. But we do need to have the apology here. With your staff just letting us have the written apology. I just want to make sure everyone understands that, and that those of you who have a transport problem, please try and SMS the chair or the secretaries. The plane is delayed, you know, something to that effect, so that we do know we can get a quorum, etc., etc. But I want to thank the committee for their hard work and to note that I will once again approach the management, both the political management with respect, that's the Honourable Froelich, about the study visit. Because it wasn't a matter of that why we wanted to go was a problem. It was a financial reason. But things are quite dynamic financially, are they not? So let us leave that one there. And I will do that and come back to you on Tuesday to let you have a status report on that. But I once again thank you, all of you, for your application of your minds to the work here. Thank you. The meeting is adjourned until the 6th at 10 o'clock it is going to be. 10 o'clock. 10 o'clock, not 9:30. And that's because of one of the presentations, the problem with them, all right? I don't want you wasting time here. 10 o'clock Tuesday, meeting adjourned.